This webcast is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Jacobs Music Company is the proud sponsor of Between the Keys with Jed Distler. Information on any of the products or services that Jacobs Music offers is available on their website, www.jacobsmusic.com. This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and I welcome you to Between the Keys. I'm so happy you've tuned in. Mark Ainley is one of our leading authorities on the art of piano playing and also on historic recordings of great pianists. In the year 2009, Mark Ainley launched the Facebook page called Mark Ainley's Piano Files. It provides music lovers an opportunity to explore the world of great pianists through their recordings, and it also includes photos, video clips, essays, and other important documents. Mark Ainley has given numerous talks and lecture demonstrations on this topic all over the world. Last year, Mark Ainley and I recorded an extensive conversation, and I mean very, very extensive, where we talked about the importance of historic recordings, as well as discussing in great detail the lives and the legacies of three pianists whom we will explore on today's episode: Dinu Lapati, Marcel Meyer, and George Bolette. So let's now go to my conversation with Mark Ainley. Enjoy. Mark, I'd like to ask you about your Facebook page, The Piano Files, which has become this incredible resource of historic recordings, videos in some cases, commentary on historic pianists, as well as a lot of people in the piano community responding to what you're putting up. Can you tell me how The Piano Files came about?
It was really quite accidental. I was an early Facebook adopter, relatively. I think I joined in 2007 and was, like many people, just using Facebook to connect with friends. And I had forgotten this story until recently an old story popped up and reminded me that a friend of mine had posted, after I had shared something on my personal page on Facebook, maybe you could share a list or share some recordings that we could listen to get to know the piano a little bit better. I had seen some of, you know, pages that had been created on Facebook for certain themes. And the name Piano Files, F-I-L-E-S, had come to me some years before as a sort of a playing around with the term piano files with a P-H, in the sense of people who are really fanatical with an F or a P-H perhaps about the piano. And so I started this page, The Piano Files. And I originally started a group format on Facebook. And then I realized that the group setting was a bit of a different operating mechanism than the page setting. So to distinguish the two, I was trying to cancel the other group and Facebook wouldn't allow me to get rid of the page. So when I was getting people to join, I added my name at the end of it so they knew which one to join. So I created The Piano Files with Mark Ainley. And so I created that page in July of 2008. And in those days, Facebook wasn't limiting the algorithm, and so anybody who joined was getting the updates. And people started joining really quite quickly. Within the first 100 or 200, I think you had joined, and several people who are longstanding members now, it's been almost 10 years, were on the page. And it turned into, as you said, there's some lively discussion. I just decided to share some of my favorite recordings, and I'll maybe say a little bit about the artist and some of the qualities of the playing. I was quite surprised that, you know, over the years, it's, you know, the membership has grown quite significantly. And there are, I'm very happy to say, some of the children or grandchildren of some of my musical idols were on the page. The late Christina Malkuzinski, the daughter of Witold Malkuzinski, was a member of the page. Anne Mottier, who's the granddaughter of Arthur Schnabel, who we've spoken of, she's a member of the page. Veronique Firkuschny, the daughter of Rudolf Firkuschny, is on there. And also some other pianists who I'd heard of.
How do they feel about having these recordings representative? Are they happy about it?
They're delighted to see, to know that their parents and their parents and grandparents are being remembered and they're being shared and that they're being still, that their art is being heard and that they're being so appreciated. In one case recently, I posted a Rudolf Virkuzny performance for his birthday. And somebody was commenting, oh, I'll never forget his Brahms D minor concerto. Noble, elegant, refined. And that was just him walking on stage to play it. Mm-hmm. And I shared that with his daughter, and she was absolutely delighted because that very much was his character and his persona.
Have people responded to you with other recordings or suggestions?
In fact, I've discovered a lot of pianists who I didn't know about through running this page, because I would look through Facebook, I would look through YouTube, and look for other artists and subscribe to certain channels who posted historical recordings. And again, like I was saying, I'm not doing this alone. And, you know, mm-hmm. I require, there are people who are uploading these recordings to YouTube, who I upload some recordings as well. But there are so much that's already on there, and those people have helped, in a sense, introduce me to some pianists I might otherwise not have known of. Marila Jonas is one, for example, who I had never heard of until, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago after running this page, and I came across her incredible recordings.
Well, she was a very popular Polish pianist for a few years in the 1940s, and in fact, they just reissued a box set of her complete recordings for the Columbia Masterworks label, which I happened to write the notes for.
She was a pianist who I had never heard of, and I've been in this lark for quite a while. And so in operating this page, mm-hmm. I've really come to find some great artists.
You mentioned the APR label, which is based in the United Kingdom, and they have done really fantastic reissues, mainly with pianists over the last few years. And you have annotated recordings that they've brought out. You were involved with their Dinu Lapati release. And what was interesting is that in the Dinu Lapati release, there was a recording of his very famous interpretation of the Bach Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring, transcribed by Myra Hess, but in a performance that was relatively obscure.
Yes, that Lapati recorded that piece in 1947 and again in 1950 in his valedictory series of recordings, and that was recorded both on 78 RPM disc and on tape in mm-hmm. 1950, because the sound was better and he was more satisfied with that recording. EMI has generally reissued that 1950 recording, and the 1947 version, which circulated on 78 and was a bestseller, never made it onto LP, even though there were certain LP releases that gave the 1947 recording date. If you listen to the performance, you can actually tell it's the 1950 recording. Mm-hmm. And so this 1999 CD on the APR label was in fact the first ever reissue since the original 78 was issued in 1947 that particular performance had come out. And on that disc as well, there's the 1947 version of a Chopin waltz that Lapati recorded. It's the only single Chopin waltz that he recorded before he put onto disc and tape in 1950 the complete standard cycle of 14 waltzes.
And the performances, I think, are very different.
They're very different, and I think this is one of the things that's very important. If we can hear the same pianist playing the same piece of music differently, it brings up, I think, some very interesting questions for musicians, and I think even for people in other areas of their lives, in terms of continuity, in terms of vision, in terms of evolution, and musically in terms of what is the role of the interpreter and the performer.
I think we should listen to these two performances of the Chopin waltz. Let's listen first to the 1950 performance, and then we're going to follow that with the 1947 performance.
Thank you.
We just heard Dinu Lapati performing Chopin's Waltz in A-flat major, opus 34, number 1. The first performance was from 1950. It's from the set of 14 waltzes that Lapati recorded for the EMI label. The second performance we heard was from 1947, just a single recording. What a difference between the performances.
The spirit is very different, but also the piano and the tone and the overall conception, I think, are so radically different. And I think there are multiple factors here that need to be considered. The 1947 recording was on a full concert grand, an incredible Steinway, number 299, that was at Abbey Road Studio number 3. I would love to find out what happened to this piano because it was so incredibly regulated. And a number of great artists recorded on that piano. Geza Anda, Beno Mazejewicz, Artur Schnabel in his last recording, Alfred Cortot, an incredibly responsive piano. And Lapati's massive dynamic range, the full bass sonority, the great resonance, but also his spirit is much more bold and adventurous and tempestuous. And it might also be where Lapati was in his life, where he had Hodgkin's disease already, but it hadn't yet strengthened its hold on him. And I think he had more strength and a bit more power in reserve. In 1950, Lapati was so ill that he was unable to tour. He had set up what he called his less tiring program of the Bach B-flat Partita, Mozart A minor Sonata, 2 Schubert Impromptus, and the 14 Chopin Waltzes. And he recorded the Chopin Waltzes in a small studio. And there were 2 pianos that were made available. One was a full concert grand, and the other one was a shorter grand. And it's not exactly clear which one was used, although I've recently been given, again, a gift through Facebook, the daughter of one of the recording producers who worked on those recordings, Anthony Griffith, who spoke of those recordings being one of the greatest experiences of his life, to having had the privilege to be part of those recordings. He spoke of, in these unpublished memoirs, which Vanessa has very kindly offered to me, he wrote that the Bach was probably recorded on the shorter piano and the others on the larger piano. That said, whether it was the microphone placement or the size of the studio and that it was less aerated, Lapati's bass sound doesn't sound very full in these recordings. I think Lapati goes for a more quaint salon-style performance in 1950 through the entire cycle of waltzes. It's very well behaved. There's not much pedal. There's not much bravura in that sense. But this 1947 version, there's bravura to spare. It's virtuosic. It's very, let's say, more masculine in a sense, more impetuous. There are some leaps and sudden pauses and dramatic inflections that we don't hear in that later performance that's more famous.
This is Jed Disler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and you are listening to Between the Keys. My guest is the writer and scholar Mark Ainley, and now we will return to an extensive conversation that we taped last year on the topic of 3 important 20th century pianists, Dinu Lapati, Marcel Meyer, and Georges Bolet. Mark Ainley, you have been giving lectures about certain pianists who are almost unknown to, at least to American audiences. And I'd like you maybe to talk about how you've discovered them. I'm thinking particularly about Marcel Mayer, who has the distinction of being one of the few great pianists completely omitted from Harold Schoenberg's book, The Great Pianists.
Well, a remarkable story in that regard, in a sense, is that I'm the one who introduced Harold Schoenberg to Marcel Mayer.
Oh, really?
And of course, after his books were published. So I came across Mayer.
And tell me about that experience.
I will.
Okay.
How I came across Mayer was absolutely coincidental. It was one of those, again, an epiphany moment. It was a Saturday or Sunday, Montreal, around 1988 or so, and on one of my jaunts around town looking in secondhand record stores, I went into a magazine shop and I was flipping through Gramophone magazine. It was quite expensive at the time, so I'd usually just stand there and read and sort of catch any important names that were in there. And there was this mini review there. Not a full review, but they were reviewing several records just very quickly in a column. And the reviewer mentioned a newly released reissue of the complete Ravel piano music by this obscure French pianist, Marcel Mayer, and that there was a directness and simplicity to her playing that brought to mind, for that in the ears of that reviewer, the piano roll or the automatic player piano recordings that the composer himself had made of his music, where there's not much fuss. It's just very clear and direct. And that Mayer had also studied with Ricardo Vignes, who knew Ravel and premiered many of his works. And so immediately these little bells started going off, and it was like, well, I need to find these recordings. I was very interested, and I didn't know much of Ravel, but I had often, my instinct told me that people were playing him a little bit too much like Debussy, and being a little bit too pedaled and too much tempo fluctuation, whereas I imagined also a crisper, leaner approach to Ravel. So I looked in the secondhand shops, didn't find anything, went to the A&A record shop in downtown Montreal where they sold new records, and there was a 2-LP set, in a rather garish purple cover, of Mayer playing Chabrier. And I only knew Chabrier's España, which my high school band had played. and it was $30, which in, you know, the late 80s was probably the equivalent of $60 or $70 today.
A lot of money then.
It was a lot of money then for me as a student. And yet, you know, my instincts just said, you should really buy this, you know. It wasn't just, you know, this lovely, very attractive lady with this elegant sort of posture at the piano. And I didn't know at the time, you know, she's wearing Chanel clothing that Chanel had given her herself. And
oh, my goodness.
I would later find out that what an amazing lady she was. So I shelled out the money, took these records home, and put the needle on the record, and it was never the same. There was this wonderfully crystalline, transparent sound and this fluid phrasing that I think anybody can hear immediately. There's just this elegance that comes through that really matches the elegance we see of photographs of this lovely lady.
I discovered Marcel Mayer. I discovered her complete recordings of Rameau on piano, which were made in the early 50s, I think 1953. To this day, they remain some of my favorite recordings, and not just for the playing, but it also the way they are recorded. There's a slightly nasal sound to the piano. It's the way the microphone is very close, yet it's not claustrophobic. It kind of reminds me of some of the Art Tatum recordings for Norman Granz from the early 50s. It has this intimacy that just draws you in. And I'm wondering if the sound of a recorded performance and the venue and the room tone and the microphone placement may have as much to do with the performance as the actual playing itself. What do you think?
It might. You know, for example, Vladimir Sofronitsky, this Russian pianist who didn't get a chance to leave Russia, I'm pretty good at listening to old recordings and listening through the poor recorded quality. But Sofronitsky, unfortunately, seems to have had this really bad luck of playing on these pianos that are just so horrifically out of tune that they sound like they belong in a bar room on the Wild West. And sometimes the recordings sound as if they were, you know, recorded, you know, in the basement of the concert hall. Just the sound is just so dreadful. And I was so grateful recently to hear two Moscow recitals, I think 1958 and 1960, all Scriabin recitals by Sofronitsky in wonderful recorded sound, on a fantastic, beautifully regulated piano. And I could finally appreciate the brilliant, subtle nuancing that he brings. Whereas
you could hear what the fuss was about.
I could
finally
really hear what the fuss was about, finally. And I shared some of these recordings when I was giving a guest lecture at the University of British Columbia, and the students were absolutely flabbergasted. One of them said that he was able to hear and almost see colors as Sofronitsky was playing these different trills and different keys. And Scriabin would have been delighted, because I think that's what he was going for. And so I think that sometimes we need to make allowances, and we need to be able to listen to recordings, even in poor quality. And that's why collectors like you and me will listen to some old recordings, even though the sound isn't ideal. There's scratches on them, there's pops and clicks, and maybe the sound quality isn't ideal. But what the interpreter is doing is so important that we can listen and get something from it. And on the other hand, there are some recordings where, in Dino Lipati's case, I think his last recordings were mic'd in a way that where we don't really get the full expanse of his sound.
That we get from some of the earlier recordings.
From the earlier recordings that were made with really great engineers
and
a wonderful piano.
And better pianos.
Better piano at the EMI studios. So Mayer, her recordings from the 1950s were engineered by André Charlin, who is a brilliant recording engineer. Mm-hmm. And so her playing is wonderfully captured. But there's no question, you know, if a performance is very well recorded, but the pianist is not doing what they should be doing, you're going to hear that very clearly. And there's no doubt with Marcel Mayer, you have the advantage of a wonderful piano, a wonderful recording technology, but also this incredible pianism.
Well, I would like to share, actually, you had, when we were speaking before, you suggested that we compare two different recordings of the same piece with Marcel Mayer, and maybe we can talk about those before we play them.
Yeah, so I thought we would listen to two different versions of a Debussy prelude. One of them was recorded in the 1950s, but it never came out on LP because the label that she was recording for, Le Discophile Français, went bankrupt between the time she recorded it and the time it was supposed to be released. And the test pressing was found in her daughter's collection in the 1980s, and it was released in that Référence series, but on CD. And there was a special catch here, which frustrated me to no end at the time, that you couldn't buy the CD. You had to buy three other CDs from the Référence series, and then you would get that CD for free. And of course, that was offer was only available in Europe. And here I am as a student, you know, on a massive budget, and I needed to find, you know, back before the internet days, I had to find a record company that was willing, that was willing to sell them and would ship them to Canada and so on and so forth. So I bought that, and the playing is absolutely magnificent. And what we now know is that Mayer studied not only with Ricardo Vignes, who premiered a lot of Debussy's music and knew Debussy, but Debussy himself coached Mayer in the last year of his life specifically on how to play his preludes. And so this recording of the complete preludes is very valuable. So this set of recordings was made in 1956, it appears, initially on the Référence CD that said 1957, but the new release of her complete recordings on EMI is in this wonderful 17 CD set states that this was recorded in 1956. 10 years before, in 1947, she recorded on 78 RPM discs three Debussy preludes, this same one that we're going to listen to being one of them. And it's a really magnificent piece of music.
I think you should pronounce this because my French is horrible and you speak perfect French.
Well, it's great when I can read it because the prepositions are a little bit challenging and puts me in mind of Bugs Bunny's, let me make you a preposition.
Or pronoun trouble.
Exactly.
That's Daffy Duck.
This is La Terrasse des Audiences du Clair de Lune.
Which performance should we play first?
I think we should play the later performance first. That's the first one that I had heard, and it's recorded in that wonderfully regulated, you know, on that wonderfully regulated piano that you spoke of in that studio on the I believe, the left bank of the Seine in Paris.
Okay, let's listen. We just heard from Claude Debussy's Preludes, Book 2.
La Terrasse des Audiences du Clair de Lune.
My guest is Mark Ainley, and that was Marcel Mayer at the piano. That was recorded in 1956. Now let's listen to her playing the same piece 10 years earlier. Thank you. We just heard the pianist Marcel Mayer playing from Debussy's Preludes Book 2.
La Terrasse des Audiences du Clair de Lune.
Thank you for pronouncing that properly, because I cannot pronounce that.
I couldn't properly. Say it unless I was reading it.
But what do you think the differences are between the very, very different performances?
It's radically different, and there's nothing wrong with either of them. In the late performance, we had this wonderful clarity and her beautiful sonority and that glass-like sound, which is so instantly recognizable as Marcel Mayer. And we can hear her pedal effects absolutely magnificently, and especially at the end, where you can hear her just wonderfully shift her pedal on the final chord to create this fade out.
But I thought that the earlier performance was a little more spacious.
Much more spacious, but it's not just more spacious, but it's mystical. In this earlier recording, she slows down much more as phrases are coming to an end, or as she's about to play the next note at the beginning of the next bar. And a little bit like the way I'm speaking now, when you speak, you can bring out a different atmosphere by pausing in a slightly different way. And sometimes it can sound kitsch, and sometimes it just sounds dramatic. And in this particular case, whatever mood Mayer was in, for whatever reason, she captured a whole other ambiance. And her tonal range, her pianissimo, right at the end where she's playing these final notes, it's so soft and controlled, and you're just waiting for the next note to play, and it's so magical. What's amazing to consider is we never know when an artist is going to be on in a particular way. And for an artist to be on in a recording studio is so challenging. There's no audience. There's no real chemistry a lot of the time, unless they've got a really wonderful producer who's there who can, you know, encourage them and spur them on. Myra Hess spoke about hating the recording process, and every time that red light went on, you know, she felt so nervous, and she felt that she was never at her best in the recording studio, yet she left us some wonderful recordings.
And I Sviatoslav Richter was like that. He used to call the recording studio the torture chamber, and yet he made some excellent studio recordings.
I think a number of artists feel that way, and Benjamin Grosvenor told me, you know, he prefers in a sense, there's a dynamic interchange that takes place. There's an aliveness to playing in concert. And yet, of course, recordings are a necessity and a reality, and it's wonderful for us now, of course, to be able to listen to artists who we couldn't hear in concert because they died before we were born. And so Mayer, for whatever reason, I think she was always in fantastic shape. I don't think she made any recordings that are substandard whatsoever.
Earlier, we were talking about the difference between studio recordings and live recordings, and how some pianists light up in a way in front of an audience that they don't necessarily do in a recording studio. One very good example is George Bolette, was born 1914. He died in 1990. And this is a case of someone who made a lot of recordings very late in his career, and they're very beautiful in some ways, yet they often lack energy and dynamism. Yet Ward Marsden has recently brought out live recordings of him that are very, very different.
Bolette is a fantastic example, because I held the opinion that he was kind of a more relaxed, slightly less passionate,
reserved
pianist. And in fact, one of the great regrets of my life is the fact that in, I believe, 1988 or 89, I was invited to attend some recording sessions, and I was given the choice between hearing Bolette record Rachmaninoff's second, perhaps a Chopin concerto, or the Montreal Symphony Orchestra playing Debussy. And he said, oh, you know, the pianist, he's really quite slow. The musicians in the orchestra aren't really finding it passionate enough. And so I didn't know Bolette's lineage at the time, and so I went to the Debussy recordings instead. And it's one of the deepest regrets that I have, that had I heard his 1974 breakthrough Carnegie Hall recital that was recorded for RCA Records, which really shows that dynamism and volcanic, impassioned pianism and stunning virtuosity at the age of 60, no less, that is, I think, lacking in his studio recordings without an audience. Had I heard that, I would have absolutely gone in an instant. And if I'd known that he'd known and heard Hoffman and had heard Rachmaninoff and all of these greats, it would have been such a pleasure to meet him, and it's a great regret.
The other thing that's interesting is Bolette, I think, acknowledged this, what we're talking about, and according to the booklet notes of this reissue of his live recordings, he encouraged people to sneak in tape recorders to his concerts.
My perception of him was, in fact, completely mistaken. Was a 1978 private recording that was made after he had given a masterclass at the Curtis Institute, and he had apparently sat down and was having a conversation with all of the students and everybody that was present, and would just go into a piece of music and play it, and then talk some more and go into a music and play it. And I was visiting Gregor Benko, the founder of the International Piano Archives.
Yes. Mm-hmm. His name has often come up here.
Yeah. He said, you know, you should listen to this recording. And it was a small portable tape cassette recorder that he had. And I remember this on the table. And he presses down the button, and out comes the most volcanic, impassioned, sky-opening playing. And the sunlight's coming through the window. I've got this full sense memory of my perceptions of Bolette being completely shattered, and how inconsistent what it was that I was hearing was with my perception of an artist. And I just realized right then and there, I really need to reevaluate this. And isn't this fascinating, that what it is that we're hearing of this artist on his commercial recordings really is nothing compared to this performance of a Chopin Godowsky Etude, Opus 10 number 1, that he played after having taught for I don't know how many hours, while in conversation with people, and he just sits down and plays it, and it was the most mind-blowing, incredibly virtuosic and musical playing, and filled with passion, over the top. And it was so different from anything that I'd heard of him.
Well, what I think we should do is to play his commercial studio recording of that Godofsky Etude. It's Chopin's Etude Opus 10, number 1, arranged by Leopold Godofsky, where the right-hand arpeggios are taken up in both hands in opposite directions, and it's quite a tour de force, and it's not very easy to play. I should know it because I've tried to play it. And Bolette's studio recording is very beautiful in and of itself.
He has beautiful tone. It's very polished. It's very elegant. It's distinguished. There's nothing wrong with it as an interpretation. It's beautiful playing.
But dot 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 dot.
But dot 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 dot. We'll listen to this one, and then we'll listen to another version.
Thank you.
We just heard two performances back-to-back of the Chopin Godowsky Etude in C Major with pianist George Bolette. The first was a studio recording, and the second one came from a live performance. As Mark Ainley and I were commenting, the live performance is faster and more dynamic and full of fire, while the studio recording is relatively sedate, yet it's very beautiful on its own terms, it's full of elegance, and there's a sense of gravitas that I think that suits this music just as well as a more fiery approach. At least I think so. Mark Ainley, thank you so much for speaking with me, and thank you for being here. It's great to have you in New York.
It's been a real pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
We have been listening to a conversation with myself and Mark Ainley. I invite you to check out his Facebook page, The Piano Files with Mark Ainley. It's a wonderful resource for music lovers interested in or curious about the great pianists of the past. This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and thank you for tuning in. I hope we will be together next week at this time for Between the Keys. This program is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.